On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we recap the weekend, which featured seven sweeps and another manager got fired. We talk about the Orioles letting go of Brandon Hyde, the Dodgers DFAing Chris Taylor, Jose Alvarado was suspended, and so much more from the weekend. Of course, we will talk about the Subway Series and tell you all about the Rockies losing once again. That and more on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbecast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks Juan Soto should boo the Yankees. I'm Jake Mintz. That's George Houston. And can you imagine, like, Soto's out in right field, Judge walks to the dish, and he's just throwing thumbs down. He's booing him from the outfield.
Oh, I like that. So he's not booing the fans back. He's actually just booing his former teammates.
Yeah.
I think that is wonderful. I agree. These players should have more control to fight back against the fans telling them that they suck. We are going to talk about Juan Soto's return to the Bronx later on, but it is not our first topic on this Monday edition of Baseball Barbecast because we had seven sweeps and a whole bunch of news. Let's begin, Jake. How sweep it is? Not
that
for
sweep.
The Baltimore Orioles.
The Baltimore Orioles on Friday night in the Beltway Series, the Drain the Swamp Bowl, get waxed, kind of, by the Washington Nationals in game one. Orioles have a nice, like, they're in the game, and then they kind of, fumble it away in embarrassing fashion late on some lackluster energy, like covering first slowly. Adley Rutschman walked after a pass ball that led to a run.
We're pitching to James Wood, who's like the only guy in the Nats lineup that can hurt you, except for CJ Abrams for the rest of the weekend. More on him in a second. And it's just, it was a close game, but it was the kind of loss. This is what I wrote when I wrote about, by the way, Brandon Hyde got fired. We're going to talk about that. it was the kind of loss that looks like the loss that you get fired over. Now, again,
correct,
that's not why he got fired, but it was very much this was his 21-0 in a different way than Bud Black.
And when teams are losing like this and they're in a rut, not every loss is created equal. There are some losses that feel like a different flavor of rock bottom because of how the loss happens. Like, if you lose 6-2 and the other team strings a bunch of hits together and hits a homer and you're never in the game, like, that's it's a bad night, but it doesn't stick with you in that way. Well, this loss was as
was
sticky
say.
As that gecko thing they give you at the dentist's office.
Oh man, it stuck. But you just mentioned the kind of loss you just described. Well, that happened the next 2 days. Do you want to talk about, let's finish out the rest of the series. So they fire Brandon Hyde, which obviously is our main topic, and then
Saturday
it's
morning.
Just now we're just rolling over to a degree that is troubling. Now, is it rolling over or is it just your pitchers aren't very good? You have Kyle Gibson giving up 6 runs in the first inning, and then he gets DFA'd. The Orioles score against the Nats bullpen, which they couldn't do on Friday. The Nationals still hold on to win 10-6. And then on Sunday, you feel like you have a better chance because Zach Eflin, in theory, is one of your good pitchers. He is also quite bad. Mike Soroka is good. The teams combined for 22 hits, 8 homers, 20 strikeouts, and 1 walk. They were swinging early and often, both teams, on Sunday afternoon. CJ Abrams hits 2 homers. He's been incredible and might be an all-star again. Nationals win 10-4, their first sweep of the year for the Washington Nationals. The fourth time the Orioles have been swept as the Orioles fall to 15-30. And Brandon Hyde, it is no longer his problem. Jake?
Yeah.
The Orioles have fired their manager. This is something that, as we have talked about, their descent to the bottom of the American League East, not just the bottom of the American League, the bottom of the American League.
The bottom of the baseball.
The bottom of the baseball over the past few weeks. We have wondered if this was going to happen. And now here we are. As we have already, we've already kind of flexed our manager got fired, talk about it on the podcast muscles with Derek Shelton and Bud Black. And this is an interesting one. This is a very different situation, right? We kind of knew the Pirates and Rockies were going to stink, and they stunk, and then the bad team fired the manager because they were bad. In this case, this was a team that certainly had flaws on the roster, which we can get into, but even the worst version of this team should not be 15-30. Now, is that Brandon Hyde's fault? Probably not, but it was not surprising to me to see this be kind of the end of the road for him. But I'm sure you have a lot more thoughts, having watched more Orioles and been around this team more. So I'll kick it to you here.
Yeah. So Brandon Hyde, I think the context here is important. So Hyde gets hired after 2018. Is one of the first thing that Mike Elias, the general manager, does is hire Brandon Hyde. And at the time, you don't really expect Hyde to survive the rebuild, right? He is hired because people think that he's going to do a good job of keeping everybody's spirits up and ensuring that development is happening at the big league level while the Orioles are a catastrophe in the win column, right? And that does happen. And I think part of the way you can see that as a success is how many players kind of make it through the rebuild to contribute to the Orioles in 23 and 24. Santander, Hayes, Mullins, like Brandon Hyde deserves a lot of credit. Jorge Mateo, Ramon Arias, he deserves a lot of credit. Mountcastle, he deserves so much credit for that, right? Because I think a different type of manager, maybe that doesn't happen, right? Now, if that was Brandon Hyde's not superpower, but most important characteristic, for whatever reason, that did dwindle this year. His ability to keep the spirits up amidst all this flavor of losing, that power went away a little bit, which is unfortunate. Now, that happens with managers over time, right? It may be the people in the room, the energy, like the energy changes, or it just wears off. That's okay. It's not like, doesn't mean Brandon Hyde's a bad person. But I do think that in this case, multiple things are true, where finding someone who can keep the spirits up within this context, like that's important. That being said, the issues the Orioles have are far beyond Brandon Hyde's pay grade.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what your manager says and the energy he creates and the atmosphere he fosters when your pitchers stink. And that's the case with the Orioles, and their general manager, Mike Elias, said as much in the press release, saying that, you know, taking responsibility, in theory, for building a flawed roster.
Yeah, but as these things work, they don't usually fire themselves. And so you end up firing the manager. I do want to shift the conversation to Elias in the front office in a second, but
that's crazy. Like, organizational seppuku. Just like
but again,
I have failed.
What you're referencing,
I'm out.
What you're referencing is again the start of the statement where he's like, you know, the losing is as head of baseball operations, this is ultimately my responsibility. And then it's like said Michael Elias. Then it's like, part of that responsibility is making tough decisions. The tough decision is to fire Brandon Hyde. It's like, not like I need to leave, but of course we know that we can't act like surprised that this is how this works. The one other thing I want to say about Hyde. Not that I want to pile on, but I do think it's just like, as we evaluate the tenure, I do think that the vibes, because I think your point about, you know, not the progress that was not being made from a development standpoint in terms of the talent that they had in place step forward. We're mostly focusing on the offensive side of things, which, by the way, has also been extremely disappointing. I also think that just how they went out the last 2 years, particularly last year, and you think about like, okay, is Brandon Hyde the reason that they completely fell on their face 2 straight Octobers? Probably not, but that is a different leadership task to play at your best when the games mean the most, and that did not happen the last 2 years. Now, this is a much worse problem where you are an actively bad team and not one that gets to October and loses, but I have to imagine those showings
that
did not necessarily
matter.
Help either.
If they reach the ALCS in one of the last 2 years, I think maybe he does get a little bit more leash, but they didn't, and so he doesn't. One last thing here for me. I think it's disappointing and borderline embarrassing that neither general manager Mike Elias nor owner David Rubenstein have spoken to the media and addressed Hyde's firing directly. Elias last spoke publicly, not via statement, I believe on May 2nd. Since then, the Orioles have won 3 games. Including that night.
And that was after he gave a vote of confidence.
Correct. Now, I'm not criticizing him for giving a vote of confidence and then pulling that vote of confidence back. Like, things changed.
They kept losing.
Decision, whatever.
Yep.
But the idea that, like, he has not said, like, he has not faced the music here. If he's going to take responsibility for failing to construct the roster, as well as he could or should have, then that is part of the job. When the Pirates fired Derek Shelton, Ben Cherington, for all of his faults, faced the music and answered questions and addressed it directly. For whatever reason, Elias has not done that. And Rubenstein hasn't done that. And I think that the honeymoon period with Rubenstein has officially worn off here.
Bingo.
When he comes in at the beginning of last season and takes over from previous ownership, Orioles fans are like, oh my gosh, we have someone who's going to spend money. He's from Baltimore. He cares. He's rich as hell. He's not here to just, you know, use the team like a piggy bank. And then we get a bizarre offseason where money is spent poorly by Mike Elias. Mm-hmm. And then we get a David Rubenstein bobblehead night.
Well, and this
looks so bad now.
This is the thing. It's not just, oh, we want the people in charge to be accountable. It's that David Rubenstein's been out there, which we appreciate.
I appreciate it. You made yourself a character here.
Yeah, literally.
And so you need to handle both sides of that. You can't just be out and about when things are good, shaking hands, kissing babies, making bobbleheads of yourself. When the S hits the fan, you need to stand up there and be like, things are not good enough.
We saw this video of you in spring training talking to the team and being like, you guys can win a World Series. And now you're headed for last place by a lot and might be, you know, sellers at the deadline. To your point, like, that's the thing. We'd still rather the owners be out there and engaging and like willing to, like, that's still a preferred thing. But to your point, it has to be both ways. You have to own in every sense that the team you own is very bad, and it doesn't mean they're doomed forever. There are still part, and this is as we spin this forward before we move on to our next six sweeps. They're like, this isn't a total disaster doomed. When are they ever going to be good? It's not. It's not that. They might finish in last place this year. They might be sellers. There is clearly a lot of questions on the mound as to how that's going to get fixed in time to compete in the AL East. That's all true. But like, if you're a manager this upcoming offseason, and by the way, you know, Tony Mancelino is the interim. He's been their third base coach the last few years. He's really the only guy who's like been on a major league staff for a long time. And so that's why he makes more sense than bench coach Robinson Chirinos or Buck Britton, who has been managing in the minor leagues for the Orioles, but is on a major league staff for the first time this year.
Inexplicable that they had Freddy Gonzalez experience big league manager as the bench coach for a number of years and then decided to let him go. And then they're left in this situation where, with all due respect to Tony Mancelino, like, that's not someone who necessarily knows how to do the job. And they left themselves in a bizarre position. But I
agree. Yeah. That is a strange outcome. And that's this year, right? So however this year turns out, which at this point, we're not expecting much. I think if you're a manager out there, you probably would rather take this job than the Pirates or the Rockies.
I mean, 100,000%.
Like, duh. And now that sounds obvious, but like, I think this is still going to be an attractive job to a lot of managers. Now, I think it's also interesting because, you know, how much is Rubenstein involved in that versus Elias involved in that, right? Rubenstein was not around when Elias got to pick Brandon Hyde. There's so many questions to that, but the point is that the Orioles are not doomed forever. There are still pieces in place here that a lot of people outside of the org would be like, yeah, I'd love to get my hands on that. And so this year might be lost. We'll see. But it will be fascinating to see the direction that they go.
Building a team out of a rebuild is a different task than the final step, than the push into dominance and sustained contention and crafting a roster that can compete, right? And we know that Mike Elias is very good at the first thing. And there were doubts around the game that he would be good at the second thing. And those doubts have come to fruition in exactly the way people thought it might, where he has this level of, it's kind of hubris, like, he has this fealty, this fanatical dedication to the process, right? To not overpaying, to finding surplus value.
You're trying trying to win transactions and you're ending up
bingo
losing baseball games.
Bingo. And now, look, I understand maybe why he has that thought process, because it has worked. That is how they got good in some ways, right? In the first place. And he deserves all the credit in the world for that. Here's what's going to be telling. Does Mike Elias change behavior based upon how this season has gone? Right? Does he alter his approach or not? If he doesn't and tries the same thing again and says, oh, maybe in 2026 we'll have fewer injuries and our luck will be better, I think that's foolhardy. He might not. That to me will indicate how the Elias Rubenstein relationship moves forward. Mm-hmm. I think that's super interesting. Enough about this.
Yeah. Because we will evaluate as the trade deadline approaches, the Orioles will become very interesting, but we will push that conversation down the road, assuming they cannot get out of this incredibly deep hole that they have dug themselves. But let us move on to another sweep, and another sweep that unfortunately came with some not so good news for the team that was doing the sweeping. As we have said on this podcast recently, the Pittsburgh Pirates, we are not going to talk about how bad they are in depth anymore, but they are very bad as they get swept by the Philadelphia Phillies in the Poop Bowl. The Poop Series returns, but unfortunately, the POOP did not last on the scoreboard very long. Because actually, it did on Sunday, for that matter. With the first two games, the Phillies won very handily. They get a great Ranger Suarez start on Friday. They win that game 8-4. Zach Wheeler looks fantastic on Saturday because he's Zach Wheeler. Bryson Stott hits a home run. They win 5-2 on Saturday. And then Sunday was a delightful pitching matchup. We got Mick Abel making his major league debut, Philadelphia's first-round pick back in 2020, against Paul Skeens. You know Paul Skeens. He's pretty good. Paul Skeens goes CGL. Kind of amazing first time that Paul Skeens has done this. It feels like he's been building towards this since he made his major league debut to get the complete game loss, and that is exactly what happens here.
Dude,
as the Phillies win 1-0. I mean, Skeens was awesome.
He allowed three hits.
Yep,
the only run he allowed, it was like infield single that probably should have been an out from Cabrian Hayes. Single up the middle, first to third. Ground out 1-0.
Yep. That was it. That was enough. And Mick Abel was marvelous. Awesome. He is, again, I mean,
we don't have time for this. Where it's just like fascinating character.
Pitching prospects. This is a great like pitching prospect arc where the stuff's always been good, strikes have not been good, and you kind of start to give up on him even though he's like 24. Not even, is it
23.
And then he was bad in AAA last year, bad in AA the year before that. And then this year, he just turned it on. He'd been dealing in AAA, and for all the focus on Andrew Painter, because he was kind of the hot new thing, Mick Abel's just been doing his thing and finally started to throw strikes this year. He gets the call up here, and because Aaron Nola is hurt for like the first time ever. Yep. And he looks great. He's 19 swings and misses, 9 strikeouts. The Pirates are obviously a terrible offense, but hey, good for Mick Abel.
So Mick Abel is going to go right back down. He knew that going in. It's just one spot start. Taiwan Walker will take that Nola's rotation spot the next time through. Amazing tidbit on Nola being hurt from Matt Gelb at The Athletic. The last time Nola was on the IL, it was the DL.
Yeah.
Aaron Nola has literally never been on the injured list.
Yeah.
He was once on the disabled list, right? Yep. That's how consistent he's been. He like hurt his ankle doing like training drills in the outfield.
Well, and that's the other great part of this, right? Like his arm's fine.
Yeah, it's not his arm.
It's not an arm injury, obviously. It's Aaron Nola. He'll throw eternally. But anyway, we haven't even said the news yet. And I'm glad you mentioned the rotation reshuffling and how this pitching staff is going to evolve. And that is because, yikes, Jose Alvarado has been suspended 80 games for testing positive for testosterone, which is not you're not allowed to do that.
There's this word here, exogenous testosterone. Mm-hmm. Did a little research. Yeah. Exogenous just means like external.
It's just like that outside. Wasn't in there before. That's what they're testing for. That's kind of the whole point.
You did not make this yourself.
Yes. And so
you plagiarized this testosterone.
Now, as usual, we get it's very disappointing. Dave Dombrowski was very candid about it, and he basically said, we don't believe he did it intentionally.
Doesn't matter.
I'm getting that in a second.
Sure.
He said, he was trying to take a weight loss supplement over the offseason and ended up testing positive. Here's the thing. You, as a professional athlete, you are responsible for not cheating, and you're also responsible for not accidentally cheating.
Correct.
No matter what, how you end up testing positive under the current guidelines in 2025, that is your problem. And so I'm sure over the years, the range of lying about testing positive has been pretty extreme. I'm sure there have some players that have straight up lied and said, I had no idea. And 100% knew what they were doing. I'm sure there are situations maybe like this one where it's like, I had no idea. I got screwed. All of it falls under the same umbrella of this is part of your job is to not take things that you're not supposed to. And this is what happens. And it's really disappointing.
That's what the money is for. You are being paid millions and millions of dollars. As a part of that, you need to make sure what going in your body is fine. Like, there are resources for you to check, play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
And
Jose Alvarado out 80 games, and it's a big deal, right? So he has been the best Phillies reliever this year. This Phillies bullpen has been pretty horrible.
Yeah.
It has been a little bit better as of late.
Yeah,
so
better. April was not good.
Last winter, they let Jeff Hoffman leave, and they let Carlos Estevez leave. And they entered this year with a quartet of relievers that they felt really good about in high leverage. And that was Alvarado, Matt Strom, Ryan Kirkering, and Jordan Romano, who they signed. Kirkering and Romano got off to horrible starts. Strom and Alvarado, both lefties, were good. Kirkering and Romano have been a little bit better recently, but now with Alvarado being done until mid-August and ineligible for the postseason,
that's the big one. Yeah.
That's a big one.
The postseason ineligibility, I think, in this case, you know, we talked about it when Profar goes down and, oh, he's not eligible for the postseason. It's like, whatever. The Braves lineup is probably going to be either good enough or not good enough.
Correct.
And it's not going to depend on Jurickson Profar. Jose Alvarado is a massive part of the Phillies' path to success in the postseason.
Correct.
And now he will not be part of it.
Oh, it's the eighth inning. Juan Soto's due up. Oh, it's the seventh. Otani's like any lefty.
Oh, Yordan Alvarez. Sorry. Never mind.
Out.
Too soon.
Out.
Oh, never mind. Ball hit to outer space. Okay, well, whatever. You understand what we're saying. For the most part, Jose Alvarado is a good guy to call on in the postseason.
Correct. So now what? Right? Now you have a unit that was already kind of undermanned and understaffed that is going to need to add an external reliever. Right? They're going to go make a trade. Dave Dombrowski, Dealer Dave, is going to do what he needs to do.
In this case, we know he's going to do something.
He's going to get a guy.
There might be some front offices that are like, no, sure, we'll be fine without this. It's like,
I will say there is no obvious guy this year. Where last year it was like, Tanner Scott is going, right? Last year, Tanner Scott, going to reach free agency. Like, he, great pitcher, rental, like top 10 reliever in the world. You knew he was going to
trade. Someone trade for him. Yeah,
my guess right now, if I had to guess right now, I'm going Pete Fairbanks.
Okay,
to the Phillies. That is my shot in the dark.
I could
right
see
now.
It.
Sure. But what is compelling about the Phillies is they have so many starters. They have right now 8 people that you could start in a playoff game, and 7 people.
Whatever. More than most teams.
More than most teams. Right? Wheeler, Lizardo, Christopher Sanchez, Aaron Nola, who I know has been iffy to start the year, but the road leads to Aaron Nola having a 3.97 ERA and giving up 2 runs in 6 innings in a playoff game. Like, that's just, or 3, right? That's just how it goes. Aaron Nola, Christopher Sanchez, Taiwan Walker, who's going to move back to the rotation, Ranger Suarez, Andrew Painter, top pitching prospect, and Mick Abel. Like, they have these 8 guys. Some of them are going to be in the bullpen in the playoffs, right? 4 of them, probably, because you can only have 4 starters in the playoffs. And so, like, how they choose to roll some of those guys into the pen over the second half of the season to prepare them for October, super, super interesting to me.
Yeah. And by the way, we should mention, like, what, Taiwan Walker, wasn't he like the worst pitcher in baseball last year? He's been a little bit better. And he's been a little bit better as a starter, but has also had like these weird brief blips of pitching in relief, and that's like looked okay too. So Suarez, as you mentioned, like he has some experience going to the bullpen, and then how they handle the younger guys, right? I mean, Mick Abel, who has built up a starter's workload over the last few years, like that, he's more of the traditional starter. Painter coming back from the surgery and this prized arm that you want to make sure you're not messing with too much. Maybe they would rather him be in relief because then you're monitoring his innings, but then you're making it a little bit more difficult on your pitching staff if you're being super conscious of when Andrew Painter is available. Like, there's going to be a lot of factors that are going to impact, and injuries will happen between now and then anyway with some of these other pitchers for the most likely. So for now, they don't have Jose Alvarado. And I mean, that's the other point that I would make is like, yes, sure, those guys could be in the bullpen. I mean, it's basically impossible to replace Jose Alvarado because there's only like three players on the planet that throw that hard with your left hand.
He's the hardest. He's the hardest throwing left-hander in the major leagues. He has a higher average fastball velocity this year than Chapman.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Chapman's still throwing quite hard, isn't he? So anyway, but yes, the point is that's not a really a genre you can just fill in. But yes, there are other avenues for them to fill out their bullpen. We will see how that goes.
Oh, I'm going to go get the other lefty that throws a hundo. Oh, wait. Can't.
Who's that?
Let me go get Jack Bauer. I'm going to draft Jack Bauer and put him in the pen.
Phillies will draft Doyle. They could. I don't think Doyle's making it to their pick. I don't think that's going to happen. Sorry, Liam Doyle.
Let's take a break here, and we'll do the Dodgers sweeping. No! Getting swept by the Angels in a second. All right. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast Freeway Series. Went exactly how we thought. LOL JK, the Angels sweeping the Dodgers in Dodger Stadium. How about that? Huh?
This is kind of the worst the Dodgers have looked in quite some time. I mean, quite simply. But hey, credit to the Angels. Friday night. Jack Kochanowicz, he looks pretty good. Yoan Moncada's been hitting home runs for the Angels since he got back and healthy. That's kind of fun. Dustin May has been not as awesome as you would like him to be in the current Dodgers pitching situation. Otani hits his major league leading 16th home run of the season, but the Angels win 6-2. Oh my gosh.
The Angels win.
game two, Clayton Kershaw makes his return. And he threw his hardest pitch of the season at 90.8 miles an hour, and he kind of wasn't very good for four innings. I thought it was going to be shorter than four innings based on how the first inning went, but he grinds through four. But unfortunately, the rest of his team was not so good after him. Otani goes 0-6. Freddie Freeman's four hits are not enough. The Dodgers make it sort of interesting late. Kirby Yates leaves with a hamstring injury. That's not good. And Kenley Jansen gets a four-out save. Oh my gosh, four out save. They win. I have the score wrong on here because it was obviously 11 to 9. So Dodgers scored some runs, but they still lose. Kenley's 455th save for his career. Game three. Oh my God, are the Angels going to sweep the Dodgers? Tony Gonsolin, he will not stand for that. Oh, never mind. Gives up a home run to the first batter, Zach Neto, and gives up another home run, I believe, to Taylor Ward shortly after that. Yusei Kikuchi was very good. The Angels have three homers. Travis d'Arnaud hits a go-ahead homer late. And Sean Anderson, well, I don't know what was going on here, but Ron Washington just leaves him out there. He gives up a homer to Will Smith, but still manages to get the final outs. An eight-out save for Sean Anderson, who wasn't even on the team when the season began. As the Angels sweep the Dodgers, and this sweep also comes with some interesting news.
Well, first on the Angels.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Raise the banner. I mean,
hell yeah, dude. Hell yeah.
Does this change the way I think about the Angels in 2025? No, it doesn't. No. But that doesn't mean if you're, you know, an Orange County hardo, and you're driving up to work, you know, in LA this morning, repping your red A hat. Yeah. All right. You go to the water cooler and you
I'm him. Matthew Lugo's doing? You don't got a Matthew Lugo up on in Dodger Blue. No, he's ours.
Walk. Otani, who don't need him, never heard of her.
Yeah, exactly. So it's great. Good for Angels fans. Like we said, are they still going to finish in last place? Probably. But hey, they're chasing the A's now. Only one game behind the A's. First Angels sweep of the year. Which, again, is, remember, they won like the first six or seven series, but none of them were sweeps. So their first sweep of the year, their first sweep since last July. First time the Dodgers have been swept at home in almost 2 years. Oh, my goodness. And obviously the first time they've been swept at all this season. Dodgers looking kind of crappy. So we, of course, talked going into the weekend about some of their pitching issues. You know, Roki's hurt now and Kershaw's coming back. How much is he going to help them? How much is it going to matter? They decide to DFA Chris Taylor. Now, that doesn't have to do with the pitching staff, but what it does have to do is an acknowledgement, and Andrew Friedman spoke about this also in reference to the decision to DFA Austin Barnes and call up top prospect Dalton Rushing, who we talked about last week, which is that the Dodgers are kind of, they're at least starting to sweat. They're at least realizing we can't just have too many bad players on our roster at this point.
Yep.
We need kind of everyone to help out. And even though the top of the lineup is still better than all the other teams, even if no matter how bad the bottom is, they're like, no, we do need Haesung Kim. No, Jordan. We do need Dalton Rushing. And now here they are, and Chris Taylor is no longer a Dodger.
The 2025 Dodgers are Jordan Schusterman's academic career in middle school, okay? So much talent, enough talent that they can, you know, coast to decent grades. But there does come a point where you have
some
to have...
Some point, you got to start doing your work.
You got to start doing your work.
That's true.
At some point, coasting
it's
can
really,
only get
it's
you
really
so far.
For me, it was like really freshman year of college, second semester. I was like, oh boy, like we got to get this work done.
I got to start doing
this. We got to make it happen so that I can stay here and like stay with my future wife, because that would be bad if I fail out and I don't get
sliding
to keep
doors.
Hanging out with this girl, Bailey.
But the relevant thing here for the Dodgers, right, is like, and Friedman said this, the division is competitive and the Dodgers, in their minds, need to win the division. Friedman referenced 2021 when they won 106 games and the Giants somehow in a miracle 107, and they had to do the wild card round, and it was, or the wild card game, I guess, at that point. RIP Chris Taylor, walk off homer against the Cardinals. They don't want that. I think there is a path that could have happened, a world that maybe existed, where the Padres and the Giants and the D-backs don't get off to this level of hot start, and the Dodgers are more compelled to stick with these vets longer into the season because they have more of a cushion and they don't have the level of pitching attrition that they've had. And Chris Taylor is still on the team in August and Austin Barnes is on the playoff roster. But that's not what happened, right? They are, because the Dodgers know what they're doing, they are responding to the reality that is going on in the world, and they are making what are difficult decisions to cut ties with players that matter in the room because they simply aren't good anymore. And that's the thing. Austin Barnes, but particularly Chris Taylor, unbelievable tenures. They should be very proud of what they accomplished. It is weird that like Chris Taylor's locker one day, everyone showed up and it was just belonged to Lou Trevino after it belonged to Chris Taylor for like a decade. That's odd, right?
Yeah.
But the fact is, Chris Taylor, not good anymore and didn't fit on the roster and was a waste of a roster spot, especially when Haesung Kim was kicking everybody's butt and Tommy Edman was coming back, and that spot should have gone to someone else.
Yep.
And I give the Dodgers credit for moving on.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
You have to.
And the good news for the Dodgers as we move on to our four remaining sweeps is that the Padres got their butt whooped this weekend also, as we head down to San Diego, where for the second time this year, the Padres got swept on their home field. Remember, we thought, oh my God, are they going to go?
They were like 12-0 or whatever at home.
Petco Park? Is this going to happen? Are we looking at one of the great home teams in baseball history?
No.
Turns out, no, we're not. We're not looking at that. I still very much like the Padres, but the Seattle Mariners played much better this weekend, which was nice to see considering they had kind of gone in a bit of a rut. Friday, they get six scoreless from rookie Logan Evans. They get homers from JP Cal and Rowdy. They win 5-1. Game two, Emerson Hancock is throwing harder than he ever has. That's another good sign as the Mariners look to kind of figure out their rotation with some of the injuries that they're dealing with. Cal Raleigh hits his 15th home run. Rowdy also hits a home run. Padres offense generally asleep. They get a four-out save from Andrés Muñoz. First of the season for Munoz to go multiple innings. Mariners win 4-1. And then on Sunday, Tatis is like, guys, we're not getting swept. Boom, leadoff homer. Okay, here come the Padres. Oh, nope, never mind. Their offense goes back to sleep. Brian Wu, who is marvelous, was just fantastic. Michael King was only okay. Randy Rosarena, he's hit some cool home runs in that ballpark. Shout out 2020 postseason. And they add on late, and the Mariners win 6-1 with a very nice sweep of the Vetter Cup, which I think we had some validation over the weekend where like they asked J.P. Crawford, hey, what's your favorite Pearl Jam song? He's like, I have no idea. Why are you asking me this? This is stupid.
So, I do appreciate that the Vetter Cup, the Vetter Cup is a bit. Like, we understand it's a bit, and it's a good bit, and I'm glad that it's a bit that the teams have adopted, right? Yeah. And it's better than, like, the Braves-Red Sox-Beantown rivalry, though more on that later. But yeah, man, good for the Amps.
No, it's a good. And by the way, it's also a good series win for Seattle as they now kind of regain a bit of a cushion they had atop the AL West and now get to go play the White Sox. So they head to Chicago this week. So that should be a little bit easier. But maybe the Pope's got a little bit more magic for the White Sox than they had this weekend. More on that in a second. But first, let's talk about the Reds over the Guardians in the Ohio Cup. Because this was a little bit more impressive than the Cubs over the White Sox or the Giants over the A's. The Reds have just had just one of the strangest seasons. I have no idea what to make of them. But their pitching has generally been pretty good. Brady Singer was better than Tanner Bibee on Friday. They win 5-4. The Reds' bullpen game beats Slade Ciccone's season debut for the Guardians. Will Benson hits another home run. They win 4-1. And then two more Will Benson homers on a Sunday as he is now homered in four straight games. Andrew Abbott was great. His ERA is now 1.80. The Reds win 3-1. Look at this Ohio Cup fun fact. First Red sweep over the Guardians in 13 years. Oh my goodness. The Guardians offense is not awesome. When Stephen Kwan has a quiet weekend and Jose Ramirez is not playing Superman, they are quite pitchable, unfortunately. Now, I will say, though, that I want to focus more on the Reds. The two guys I just want to highlight here are Andrew Abbott and Will Benson, because I think they're emblematic of just how the last 2 years have gone for the Reds, where both of those guys kind of burst on the scene in 2023 during this season where it's like, oh, my God, the Reds are trending up. And then both of them, I mean, Abbott was okay last year. NO's ERA was lower, but all the peripherals were worse. Benson was a disaster. And it was like, oh, God, okay, we shouldn't have gotten so excited. And now here they are, both of them back in the big leagues, contributing in a big way. And I don't know. Like, I think the Reds have enough to stay around. They also have kind of an offense that is not. Ellie has been objectively disappointing. I mean, that's another thing we kind of have to get at. He hasn't been bad, but he hasn't taken that step forward. I don't know. I think the Reds are okay. I don't think we're going to be writing them off that soon. They're a flawed team, but I think they, especially on the mound, they're pretty solid.
I'm a little worried about Cleveland on the bump. Second fewest quality starts this year behind only the Marlins. I mean, they have 8 quality starts. Right, 6 innings, 3.
They were last. They were 29th last year.
Yeah, and, but you know, they thought they had maybe could fixed be 29th. It. Yeah, but they could be 29th last year because they had like the greatest bullpen ever.
Exactly,
and they
And this year, it's merely a good one. It's merely a good bullpen. So I know I'm with you on that.
In the Pope off, Cubs taking all three over the White Sox. We got a lot of good feedback. Crosstown series,
yes,
is what appears that this is officially referred to. Yeah. Crosstown classic.
Is it always a classic? Is this edition really a classic when the Cubs are just way better than the White Sox?
It was for Pete Crow Armstrong, who went 8-14 over the weekend with a homer, 2 triples, and a double. He is now second in F4 in baseball. Yep. It goes Judge, PCA, Otani, Witt, Tatis.
I mean, look, man, we've been talking about him all year. He somehow keeps getting better. I don't know. I don't really know what more to say about PCA at this point, other than that I expect to see him with the All-Star game. And I look forward to seeing where he ends up on MVP ballots. Like, that is an astonishing thing. And by the way, it has helped because you know who hasn't been very good for the last like 3 weeks?
Kyle Tucker.
Yeah. So it's kind of helped mask that, and the Cubs take care of business this weekend against the White Sox.
There is one qualified player in baseball with a higher chase rate than PCA. That is Sosa. He is swinging at everything.
This is the other thing, and I was on Chicago radio on Sunday just talking about this. Like, there's some great, I don't know, the fact that Javier Baez, who he was traded for, is the same kind of premise where it's like, how are you getting away with this? How are you swinging at everything and still being productive? Now, Pete's underlying stuff is more promising because he's hitting the ball really hard. Like, he's barreling the ball and we know the defense that he's providing. But you do wonder, will pitchers start figuring out, like, okay, we just have to not throw him this and he is going to swing and he cannot damage this. But so far, man, he's been unbelievable.
I get it, but he's already, I'm looking at like zone rate. So that's like how often certain hitters are getting pitched in the zone, which is tells you a lot about, right? So like Luis Arraez is second on this list because guys are not afraid of him doing damage, so they throw pitches in the strike zone. At the bottom of the list, it's like Bryce Harper, because like, I don't want to throw him pitches in the strike zone and he might chase. PCA is already 8th. He's already eighth on this list. Like, pitchers are already adjusting to this.
Eighth from the bottom, you mean? Like,
eighth from the bottom. Like, he is getting the eighth fewest pitches in the zone.
Yeah.
Like, they're throwing him crap in the dirt, and
guess what?
It doesn't matter.
It sounds like it's still probably too many pitches in the zone. No, I would love for them to keep throwing it in the zone, because I'm loving this from Pete, but it is a pretty amazing profile. But like we said, the floor is so high because he's the best defensive center fielder by a mile and an amazing base runner. So, what a freaking player. So Cubs, good for them, and nice for them to finally get a bit of a break. They've had a pretty brutal schedule so far this year and remain in first place. And now they get a little bit of an easier run as they've got the Marlins, Reds, Rockies, Reds, and then Nationals. So Cubs are in pretty good shape. And Matt Shaw is coming back. Let's also mention that he is getting called back up. They sent him back down because he was playing crappy, but it's not like they had some awesome solution at third base. So it seemed like as soon as he was like back to looking decent, they were going to call him back up. And that makes a lot of sense.
Giants over the A's. Get your ass out of the Bay. Back to Sac. Thanks for coming. The
Giants broadcast, just keep calling him Oakland, and I don't blame them. This was just Wilmer Flores continuing to do magical things. He has his first career 3-homer game on Friday as Logan Webb goes 8 innings. Giants win 9-1. Landon Roop, Luis Severino were both very good. This goes 0-0 to extra innings, and then Mason Miller walks 3 in the bottom of the 10th. And you can't do that with the extra runner. Wilmer Flores, again, with that walk-off walk, his 14th career walk-off. He leads baseball with 42 runs batted in. RBIs are still cool, folks. And then in Game 3, the A's had a lead late. They could not hold it as the Giants take a lead in the 8th. And Ryan Walker closes it out. Giants win 3-2. Giants pitching staff is pretty good. Jordan Hicks is the one real weak link. I don't really know what the plan is with him. But other than that, and they have some more guys in AAA that I think could be useful for them. But on the whole, like, that's why the Giants are solid. And they now made up some ground here and are, I don't know if they're tied with San Diego or have passed San Diego, but they are the one that are now a lot closer to the Dodgers than I thought they would be at this point. So clearly the Giants are going to stay pretty relevant here.
Let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we will do Red Sox Braves, and I will tell you about my 3 days at Yankee Stadium where I did not boo Juan Soto because I am in the press box. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I spent all weekend at Yankee Stadium watching the Subway Series. The Mets on Friday got stuck in traffic on their way to the stadium. It took them about an hour and 25 minutes to go from Citi Field to Yankee Stadium. For those of you who are not big Applers, that is a 10-mile journey. One that often takes between 20 and 30 minutes, depending on traffic. It was a Friday afternoon, and it took them an hour and 20 with a police escort. Yes, the irony of being stuck in traffic, mired in gridlock on the way to the Subway Series, is an irony that I quite enjoy. And it got me thinking about the following dynamic, okay? Mm-hmm. Just the image of, what, like $1 billion worth of baseball players sitting on a bus.
Right.
Stuck in traffic on their way to the biggest game of the year. They have to live like the rest of us is very interesting to me. Because often, what does money do, right? Money peels away the inconveniences of life that normal people have to interact with, whether that is traffic, right? Whatever it is. You pay for a driver or, you know, 5 nannies and a chef, right? Money can do that. But money can't solve everything, and money can't solve traffic, right?
No.
No matter how Steve Cohen may try. And that is the message that I took away, right? The Yankees take this one. They take 2 out of 3. Delaying, oh so slightly, Steve Cohen's bid to take over New York. He used his millions to change the face of this franchise. His billions, change the face of this Mets franchise. But money can only do so much. And if that is what Steve Cohen's goal is, it will take time, just like it took the Mets stuck in traffic. Juan Soto, of course, was the star of the show, the belle of the ball, the main character. He was booed all weekend. On Friday, the fans in right field turned their backs to him, which I thought would have played better if they weren't peaking. I don't know if you saw the videos of this. That's what made this so loser energy to me.
Either do it or don't, you know? Like, the videos either of the look fans, at him or don't look at him. Like, what's the point you're trying to make?
Dude, the fans that were, like, turning their backs to him and also, like, turning to see how Soto was reacting. It's like, dude, come on. That is so, like, some fans were just turning their backs and like, okay, cool, whatever. If that's what you want to do, fine. But it's so, like, come on.
What I am, and we'll recap the series. Again, the games weren't that interesting, so we'll focus on the Soto part. What I am most compelled by is, and we sort of talked about this at the start of the season where you had made the reference to, okay, Yankees hype video is not going to include Juan Soto, even though the highlight of their season was Juan Soto hitting that home run in Cleveland to send him to the World Series. How different would it be had they won? How much of the hatred is it? We understand. He took a bunch of money and he left the Yankees and went to the Mets. It's an unprecedented move and all. We get why they're booing. But because of the postseason context, it is a really interesting dynamic. I know you had mentioned, right, like he got his American League championship ring from Aaron Boone, and it's like, okay, well, imagine
in the
if they
tunnel
had won,
not on
in the
field.
Tunnel, right? Imagine, now how do we feel about American League championship rings? That's a separate conversation, but the point is, oh well, what if they had won the World Series? Would they still be booing him? Like, I don't think so. Maybe some, but not as much, because he would have been a big part of a World Series, but he was still such a big part of getting to the World Series. So I don't know. It's, you know, the boo discourse is not usually for us, but this was the story of the weekend. So
this was a fun one. I mean, fandom is irrational, but Yankees fans holding up a sign that says sellout is just awesome.
So that's it's the awesome.
And one more thing on this. Like, I asked around the Yankees clubhouse, like off the record to a bunch of guys. I was like, yo, be real with me. I'm not going to write this. Is there lingering discontent in here about Soto leaving? Like, is there beef? And everybody was like, no. the players are not mad at this guy. Like, he got a generational amount of money to play for a different team. That's okay. The pivot that the Yankees made to acquire all these other players, which, by the way, worked this weekend on Sunday when Max Fried was awesome to start. Devin Williams threw a scoreless inning. Paul Goldschmidt hit a key RBI, and Cody Bellinger hit a grand slam to break the game open, right? There's no ill will here behind the scenes. Like, there was like
they
a clip of Judge and Soto
game.
Saying hi. Like, Judge, here's what maybe makes it more confusing, right? Is like, Judge is always coy and is going to shy away from controversy at every turn, no matter what. And so when he says, no, everything's fine, part of you is like, but in this case, that's the truth. All of the drama is external, right? And it's understandable given the stakes. I mean, it's the largest contract in sports history. And the guy went from one New York team to the other and he's coming back for the first time. Like, of course, it's a big story. And of course, they're going to boo him, whatever. But Soto rose above it from an energy perspective. He did not bite. I will say he looked horrible at the plate. He looked discombobulated, out of sorts. He didn't look as locked in. He didn't look focused. He had bad at-bats, which he doesn't have. Do I think that the energy got to him? Maybe a little bit. Maybe he was just tired and overwhelmed by it slightly. It doesn't concern me. I don't think that Juan Soto is someone who, like, is going to fold under pressure over a longer stretch. But it was interesting that the stat line was just blah as hell.
Yeah. Judge also wasn't very good this weekend. Now, the Yankees still played better on the whole. Judge had his first 0-for-5 of the season on Saturday, including to end the game against Edwin Diaz. Cody Bellinger's really kind of
heating up.
He's heating up, and that's been happening for a few weeks here, but it's a huge deal because he's the one batting behind Judge. They've stuck with him batting third for pretty much the whole year, even when he was bad. And last night was the best example, right? Judge Judge strikes out against Genesis Cabrera with the bases loaded, and you're like, ah, oh, that should have been the moment. And then like Bellinger, was it first pitch? Early in that at bat, just hits a classic Yankee Stadium moonshot that sails over one Soto's head. Right over Soto's head, fittingly. So Max Fried was great again. Pete Alonso,
the key moment of this game was Yeet Alonso.
Yeet Alonso, as I guess the Yankees have the go-ahead run on third, and there's a chopper to Pete Alonso, who it's like, oh, play at the plate. Oh, not even close.
He just made the exact same play perfectly the day before. There was like this, it was a carbon copy. He just threw this one and that was it.
And then, then it really unravels after that. And that's how we get to the Bellinger Grand Slam. And then Yankees win. So, yeah, I mean, these games were not legendary moments. You know, we're not going to be playing these ones back. Maybe we'll have better games when they play in Queens in July. Yankees did their thing. It was good.
All the celebs were there on Sunday. Russell Wilson and Sierra,
fresh off the Knicks there. Series win. Yeah,
the cat was there. Karl Anthony Towns, which was a great moment. Right, they show him on the big board, and the whole stadium cheers for the first time all game.
Dominican icon,
Karl Anthony Towns. Stephon Marbury was there.
Oh, love that.
Sure,
that's. Yeah, I don't know. Does he have Yankees versus Mets allegiance? I'm not sure. But that's true. The cat moment was definitely very cool. One more series before we turbo through the rest of it. Braves over the Red Sox. A lot going on in this one. So Friday we have Crochet against Chris Sale. Both of them were great. You know, Crochet gives up back-to-back homers in the first inning, but he really dials it in after that. The Braves hang on to win 4-2. Braves go up big on Saturday early against Giolito, who was not awesome. Up 5-0, and the Red Sox claw their way back. Duran hits a homer. He's got four runs batted in. And then Rafael Devers, first walk-off homer of his career, which is kind of an amazing stat. And the Red Sox first. Yeah, I mean, what a moment. And Devers, of course, has been raking since he refused to play first base. And then on Sunday, he hits the Red Sox first grand slam since 2023. And when Devers hits that, they retake the lead. You're like, okay, Red Sox, like now we go. You hit the, like we've broken the seal. Now they're going to just rattle off a bunch of wins. And their pitching just stunk. Bayo was really bad. Newcomb was bad after him. The Braves offense is really turning it on. Schwellenbach goes 7 innings and the Braves win 10-4. Quickly on Atlanta. They're starting to heat up offensively. They're above 500. Acuña is going to be back. I mean, I think he's going to be back this week. I would be shocked if they're going to give him that much more time in AAA, where he is already torching the baseball. So I think we're going to have Acuña back soon. And like that, with the way Baldwin's hitting, with the way Ozuna and Olsen have been swinging it, you know, Riley, like this is starting to now look like the Braves offense that we saw a couple years ago, which has to be exciting for Atlanta. And the Red Sox, I don't know, man. Like, I don't know what to make of them. Their pitching has been objectively disappointing across the board, whether it's been in the bullpen with guys like Slayton and Whitlock, whether it is, you know, Giolito's been, you know, hot and cold so far, unfortunately. And it sucks because their offense has generally been what you could hope. Now Duran's heating up. They haven't been shut out in any game. They've scored a bunch of runs, hitting a bunch of homers, a bunch of doubles. Devers has been awesome. Christian Campbell's starting to work out at first base. Is that the answer? Does he play first? Does Marcelo Meyer come up and play second? I don't know. There's a lot of options for them, but I just can't figure them out. And that's kind of been true for 3 years, but I still think they have the talent to be a postseason team. They welcome the Mets to Boston this week for 3 games. So that is compelling. Quite a run for the Mets here, going Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers this weekend in Queens. So we'll see how the Mets hold up there. I think this will be an interesting. Surely the Red Sox and Mets fans will not have feelings about this series this week. They will definitely have normal reactions to that.
Soto's going to get booed there too, by the way.
That's a good point.
Like, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
He turned down their money as well and was on the Yankees. Yeah. Like, I don't know if he's really thought about that.
It is funny to think about. Now, again, like, yes, sign Juan Soto if you can, but for all the roster mess that the Red Sox have found themselves in, it is funny to think about where Juan Soto would fit into that. That seems,
I mean, they wouldn't have signed Bregman.
Right. Last thing I'll just say about the series, since we've talked about it on Friday, is we asked on Friday, you know, this is the Bean Town. Okay, Braves. Well, they used to be in Boston. Of course, Braves, Red Sox. What a rivalry. We're like, okay, sure. Like, are there any people out there in Boston who are actually Braves fans? And we got an awesome email from Chris basically saying that he, you know, gotten a rideshare over the weekend and was talking to someone or recently. And his driver was exactly what we're describing. Now, he wasn't 95 years old. He was someone whose dad was a Braves fan in Boston, but he's stuck with it. And I it was a great email from Chris, and it just reminded me that, yeah, like this is something that can exist. Someone that in Boston, a Bostonian that cares more about the Braves than the Red Sox. And I have to imagine that driver had a good experience. Good experience this weekend watching his Braves beat the hometown Red Sox. So
I just love
cool.
The idea
Thanks
of
email, Chris.
The Braves have played wicked well.
That's exactly what they would say. All right, we have
head on
six
down
more
to Truist Park.
Truist Park. That's where the All Star Game is. Truist Park. We have six more series, and we are going to go fast. It's time for Turbo Mode.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Astros, Rangers in the Battle of Texas. They split the best of four. Awesome DeGrom, Hunter Brown battle on Friday. I would say the kicker in this one was game four. This was quite an interesting showdown. Jack Leiter outstanding with a no-hitter through 6 2/3. Allows a homer to Yiner Diaz in the seventh. Chris Martin comes in, gets hurt after one pitch. Isak Paredes, who's been amazing this season, hits a huge go-ahead homer. The Astros win 4-3. Hayden Wesneski, who was also part of the Kyle Tucker deal, needs Thomas Johnson surgery, which stinks.
Yes, Rangers rotation ERA, best in baseball. The Twins taking 2 out of 3 over the Brewers. They did not extend their winning streak to 14, but they did get it to 13 as Joe Ryan was awesome on Friday. They had 18 hits on Saturday, including scoring exactly one run in 7 of the 9 innings, one of the stranger line scores that I've seen. So 2 shutouts on Friday and Saturday, but then the Brewers salvage on Sunday. Freddie Peralta was good. Jackson Churio robs Royce Lewis of a homer, and the Brewers do just enough, win 5-2.
Cardinals over the Royals taking game one and taking game two. Royals avoid the sweep on Sunday, but there's bad news for them as both Seth Lugo and Cole Reagans hitting the IL. Does this mean Rich Hill is gonna make a start?
I don't know. These aren't major injuries. I think it's like a groin for Reagans
and like
and
a
maybe
finger.
Like a blister thing or finger thing for Lugo. So hopefully not a long thing. But I was like, what do they need Rich Hill for? I don't know. Maybe they do need him. And hey, pressure on our guy Chris Bubich. He's continued to be awesome. Let's see how he can do.
Miles Michael has heard your doubt and absolutely shoved in game two of this series, tossing 6 scoreless. There's something awesome about a pitcher who doesn't throw hard, like throwing 6 scoreless. It just feels like a John Wick movie where it's like, how does he keep getting out of this? Like,
well, unfortunately, keeping the Royals scoreless is not an especially difficult task. That is their problem. Even though they managed to win that final game of the series, that's just why we don't really believe in them, is they don't know how to score runs. Three more series. The Tigers over the Blue Jays. Flaherty was pretty good. Tigers won again on Friday. Riley Green hits 11th homer. Javier Baez highlight reel continues. He hits another homer, makes an amazing catch in center as they win on Friday. Torque is the only thing that does anything for the Tigers. Only guy that does anything for the Tigers on Saturday. They waste an awesome Reese Olson outing. Jays tied in the eighth and walk off Ernie Clement single. And then Jackson Jobe looks almost as good as he has all year on Sunday. He outduels Berrios. Torque drives in all 3 runs, and Tigers won again. They have the best record in baseball at 31-16.
Until Flo Rida shows up at the Citrus Bowl, I won't care. But the Marlins take 2 out of 3 over the Rays. Cal Quantrill with an immaculate inning. Ooh. 9 pitches, 9 strikes, 3 strikeouts. Thanks for coming out. Appreciate you very much. Rays offense manages just 2 hits in that game. Sandy Alcantara was bad again in game 2. I'm still not worried about it. We could talk about it later this week.
Last series, D-backs over the Rockies. Corbin Burns looks great on Friday. Six scoreless innings with 10 strikeouts as the Snakes win 8-0. And then just one of the messier games of the season on Saturday as the Rockies win 14-12. Zach Gallen allows 4 home runs. It is the first time in franchise history the Diamondbacks score 12 runs and lose. Jordan Beck hits 2 homers. And then it's like, oh my God, are the Rockies going to win a series? No, they get no hit through 5 innings against Merrill Kelly. It's close late, but the Snakes still hang on 1-0 as the Rockies lose once again, 15-15, losing series for the Colorado Rockies.
0-15.
Snakes, 0-15. Oh my gosh. They are so bad as the Snakes probably should have swept because it's the Rockies, but they don't. And that is the final series of the weekend.
I love the idea of the Diamondbacks moving to 151-1 all time when they score at least 12 runs.
Yeah, the Snakes, they'll do that sometimes. They are going to score runs and they are also going to allow them, unless they're playing the Rockies. That's it. That's the weekend recap. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to TJ Brassel for producing.
This is Brassel.
Wow, what a weekend of baseball it was. Some incredible softball, D3 baseball regional. So much going on. This is a fun time of year. We appreciate you listening. Email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Programming. Only 2 shows this week. We got some stuff to take care of, which means we will only have 2 shows. And that second show will be on Thursday. So you won't have to wait all the way to Friday. But we won't have a show on Wednesday. So we will talk to you next on Thursday. Thank you all for listening. And we'll talk to you later this week. Bye-bye.